wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
First off, though, before we do start, I have to tell everybody that you gave me a periodic table. Ellen came in with a gift today, and it was quite fitting because it was my birthday on Monday, so it's a pretty special periodic table poster. I don't mean to, you know, show off, but I'm feeling pretty good about this. It's all colourful.
Yeah.
You think everybody should have one of these, do you?
Well, I think they should, okay. Yes.
Let's work on that. talk to the government about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, on the show though, we are first up talking about machine learning for antibiotics.
Indeed, and this was a story that you sent me, which is not
exciting.
The normal way that these things work. So thank you for this. A very, very topical and interesting story that's just come out. So we need new antibiotics because the ones that we've got are rapidly being beaten by the bugs, as it were. So,
as in they're just getting stronger than the antibiotics?
Yeah, basically. So the bugs are mutating and they're becoming resistant to, you know, even our best antibiotics. And this is not a good thing. So we need essentially totally new classes of antibiotics because the bugs are sort of used to, you know, pretty much all of the different classes of the ones that we've got at the moment.
Where do antibiotics come from?
Very good question. Some of them are natural. Mm. So penicillin, for example, comes from mold, as everybody knows. One of the first real antibiotics was a sulfonamide drug. That's a chemical term, but that was basically synthesized in the laboratory. And the nice story about that was the guy that discovered it, his daughter had pricked herself with a knitting needle. This was back in about the early 1930s. And she got a bug infection, staph or something like that. And in those days, that was basically a death sentence.
Right.
So any infection like that, you were basically gone. And so the doctor said, oh, we're going to have to amputate her arm. And this guy said, no way in hell are you going to do that. I've made this thing in the lab. I'm going to try it. So he tried this thing on his daughter. And 2 days later, she was fine.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's a story of sort of the first antibiotic. And he ended up winning a Nobel Prize for that, which is, it's just a great story.
But I guess in that sense, too, there would be people who were using these sorts of methods of, I don't know whether, you know, some of these things come from native plants.
They do, but they weren't recognized at that time. So, and probably the majority of antibiotics now are probably sort of made in the lab type things,
right,
which may well be based on sort of, you know, natural products and stuff like that. But we desperately need new ones.
And I'm intrigued by it. Sorry, I will stop interrupting you soon. Intrigued by it because I listened to this podcast about how people were talking about, oh, we need to go out and we need to find more native plants.
Absolutely.
And speak to those sorts of, you know, indigenous groups perhaps who have actually been using these.
Yes, yep.
I've lost the word. It's medicinal, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a treasure trove in the freaking Amazon. You know, there's probably plants in there we've never even found yet. So, you know, there's all sorts of potential.
We haven't found, but
sorry. Take your point. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so machine learning, though. Where does this come in?
So, basically, it's pretty sort of hit and miss at the moment, you know, this whole antibiotic thing. So people might have some sort of idea of what might make a good antibiotic molecule. And we're looking at things like shapes of the molecules and whether the molecules are polar or nonpolar or, you know, all sorts of possible features of a molecule. And it makes it very, very difficult. So let's take the human element out of this and let's give it a computer and see if they can do better. And so the first very big success in this has just been published in Nature. And so these are folk at MIT, Harvard, and McMaster University in Canada. And so what they did was basically they took 2,000 compounds that were known to be active against a particular bug called E. coli.
Mm.
Okay. And they then sort of looked at these 2,000 compounds, they screened them in the lab, and they said, right, which ones are the best against E. coli? And then they fed these results into a computer and let the computer sort of pick out the particular aspects of those particular molecules that seemed to be required in order to show some activity.
Okay.
Which is much more than a human could do. You know, it's an enormous job. Okay?
But using algorithms.
Yeah. So it's all artificial intelligence, machine learning, all that stuff. And then they took another 6,000 compounds that were either in testing for particular diseases or whatever, okay, or had been tried and had failed or whatever. And they let the computer loose on this, and the computer came up with one very good hit. And this was for a compound that had been tried as a diabetes drug, but hadn't actually worked. And so it had just been sort of discarded.
Oh, wow.
But the computer said, no, you want to try this against antibiotics because I reckon this one's going to work. And by crikey, it does. And it figured out that this computer, and they called it Halicin, this compound called Halicin, and they named it after the Hell computer in 2001.
Okay.
You've seen 2001, haven't you?
No.
Lillian.
Okay, goodness, I'm writing it down now.
2001 A Space Odyssey. You have to watch that.
Yes,
my goodness.
Yes, sorry. Many times.
And so the computer figured out, yes, this looks really, really promising. And so they put it in the lab and they tried it against bugs. It hadn't been tried against bugs before. It had been tried against diabetes. And they found, yes, this is really good. This is killing some antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Wow.
So this is a big, big thing. And now they've set the problem for the computer to do 100 million compounds now. They've got a library.
Whoa.
They've actually got a library of over a billion compounds that they need to screen.
Like, you mean a compound which has been probably tested for something else, maybe?
Or just a compound, okay?
Wow.
So, and it went through all those 100 million in about 4 days, and
It
got down to about 23, a shortlist of 23 from that 100 million, and two of those are looking really good in the lab. Okay.
Wow.
So the problem with all of this, doing it manually, doing it humanly, is that these things need to be done in the lab. They need to do screening for each individual compound in the lab.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes an inordinate amount of time.
Mm.
So it's going to make things a hell of a lot quicker if you can have a computer try and figure out what the salient points of an antibiotic molecule are. And then it can then point you to already existing compounds, for example. Or even better, it could point you to totally new compounds that nobody's ever considered before.
Okay.
So this is big.
What is the problem, though, with, in terms of inputting the algorithms at the starting point, right? You know, what's required in terms of the information?
Well, that's
there.
The whole thing. It's the machine learning thing. Okay. So it gradually gets better and better and better. So they're using a combination of machine learning plus laboratory results.
Right.
Okay. So the machine, you know, the computer started off with those 2,000. Of which they were screening those in the lab. And you know, then they said, right, these are good, these are bad or whatever. And then the computer uses those results on the next 6,000, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow.
And, you know, now the big possible problem with this is false positives.
Yeah.
That the computer could just come up with a whole lot of positives and say, yes, try this. And that's no better than, you know, doing it sort of humanly. But seemingly they've got it to a point where those false positives are being minimized as much as they can be. And this is a big thing.
I guess it still speeds up the process. So even if they do get some false positives, which they would have got in the lab anyway, you do try them and you realize, no, okay.
Yep. And again, those data then go back into the computer and say, no, we don't want these.
Right.
They don't work.
Okay.
And it learns, you know.
So, brilliant.
Fantastic. So, you know, this is, you know, it could be the answer to our prayers in terms of new antibiotics.
Okay.
So
that's
fabulous,
brilliant.
Fabulous stuff.
Thanks for the explanation.
Yep. No, not at all.
Fraudulent whiskey or fighting the rise of it. I didn't realize there was a rise of it.
Wow. Yeah. No, well, I guess neither did I really, but this is a paper that's just been published in a journal called Radiocarbon, which I must admit I'd never heard of until yesterday, looking this up.
There we go.
So, and here's things that you didn't know, I'm sure, that the UK exports £4 billion worth of whiskey annually. £4 billion pounds. Exports. Jeez. So, you know, Scotland could go off and be independent on that lot, probably, you know. So
I think actually in New Zealand there was a note that spirits are the in terms of the volume available is increasing. So thanks to the UK, I guess.
Yes, yeah. So £4 billion worth. And so old whiskies are worth an awful lot of money. So in October 2019, there was a Macallan Fine 60-year-old from 1926, and it sold for $1.9 million, a bottle of that, at auction.
What?
$1.9 million. Isn't that mad?
For one bottle?
For one bottle of whiskey. Yeah. So you could imagine, and, you know, old whiskey worth a lot of money, so you can imagine there is going to be a market for fake whiskey out there.
Yes,
so apparently what people do is that they find the old actual bottles of whiskey and they just refill them
with not great whiskey.
Yeah, with new stuff, okay? And then they go and put them at auction. So the bottles are authentic, but the stuff that's inside is not.
Oh, dear.
So how do you prove that the stuff inside is not? Well, these workers in Scotland, surprise, surprise. So they came up with the idea of looking at the isotope carbon-14. And so that is a radioactive form of carbon. And that was formed in nuclear tests, okay? Nuclear bombs, nuclear tests, and all that sort of stuff.
Wow.
And what that led to then was a big spike in the amount of carbon-14 in the atmosphere after 1945.
Okay.
Okay, so everyone got on the nuclear bandwagon. They were all exploding these in the atmosphere and stuff. You were generating lots of carbon-14 in the atmosphere. This carbon-14 then got absorbed by plants.
Okay.
Okay, in other words, barley, which is what you use to make whiskey.
Oh.
And so the carbon-14 goes into the barley, you make your whiskey from the barley, the carbon-14 goes into the ethanol in your whiskey.
Whoa.
Okay. And what they found was that the amount of carbon-14 in the atmosphere spiked in or reached its maximum about 1964.
Yeah.
And it's been declining ever since. So what these guys did, this is really nice, is that they...
This is amazing. I know where you're going with this. This is brilliant.
So they got a whole lot of whiskey whose age they absolutely knew, okay, whose age is beyond reproach. And they measured essentially the amount of carbon-14 in each of those whiskeys brewed in particular year, you know, or distilled, sorry, not brewed, 1965, 67, blah, 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 blah. And they made basically this curve that showed the amount of carbon-14 that should be in any whiskey that was distilled in that year.
It's so brilliant.
And then the best bit, after they'd done the work, they obviously had to test it. So they got people who actually gave them whiskey. So these are private individuals. These are auction houses. And they then tested those whiskies, which were purportedly from particular years. And they found that 50% of them were actually fake.
Whoa. So, would people that were selling this know that?
I would imagine they would.
They were very well, aware.
Well, they either didn't because it was sold to them by a fraudster, or they're the fraudsters themselves. So there was a bottle of 1863 whiskey that they analysed and they said, nope, it comes from between 2007 and 2014.
2007, that is a big difference.
Yeah, just a little bit.
So, surely the people that they're selling it to would know.
Well,
if someone's going to spend $1.9 million on a bottle of whiskey, this is something you're invested in.
It is, but then there's a sort of a snob value type of thing in there as well, isn't it?
If you
open a $1.9 million bottle of whiskey and feed it to your mates, it's going to taste great, regardless of whether it tastes crap or not, isn't it? You know,
point taken.
Smooth. You know?
Yeah, so good. Okay, all right. Wow, that is fascinating.
So I think that's utterly brilliant.
Yeah,
and you know, more power to them, I think. Anything you can do to stamp out all of this counterfeiting and stuff like that.
Fake news.
And, you know, go science. Mm-hmm. Brilliant.
Brilliant. Yeah. Okay, let's do antimatter. This, I feel like this is important to you, but we might have to
rush
through.
Don't worry.
Okay.
I know. So antimatter. So when the Big Bang happened, supposedly there's meant to be an equal amount of matter and antimatter.
Okay.
And antimatter is kind of the inverse of matter.
Yes.
Okay.
I follow.
So we have, instead of having negatively charged electrons, the antimatter equivalent is a positively charged electron.
Right.
Okay, called a positron. Okay.
Yes.
So basically you've got all these inverse particles that are the inverse of each other. You have matter, which the universe is basically made of.
Yeah.
And then you've got antimatter, of which there seems to be too little in the universe.
Okay. There should be more.
Now, there should be more, or there should be less matter. There should be more antimatter, or there should be less matter, because when antimatter and matter come together, bang, gone. Okay. And that's what's used in fact, some medical imaging. If you've ever had a PET scan, for example, it's called positron emission tomography, and that relies on an isotope, and that emits positrons, and when that hits matter, then they just creates energy, basically. Okay. And so these workers at CERN in Switzerland/France, the big super collider there, so they've managed to be able to get enough antihydrogen together to be able to see whether it behaves the same as hydrogen itself. Because the big assumption here is that the properties of antimatter are going to be the same as the properties of matter. And basically, long story short, they've shown that they can do this. And so they've made around about a few hundred atoms of antihydrogen. They shine a laser at it and they find that basically they behave the same as normal hydrogen does. So
good. That's good.
Oh, no, no. It's really, really interesting to sort of the scientists and stuff like that. They hadn't been able to sort of create decent amounts of antimatter and sort of play with it until about sort of 1995 or so, sort of right. The late 90s. And so now they're being able to actually get clusters of antimatter and you know, this is cool.
Alan's got the biggest smile on his face. We'll just take it that we understand and can also empathize with the unique happiness that you feel right now.
And speaking of empathy, nice segue to the end here. My colleagues at Massey, we really, really feel for you. This is utterly, utterly short-sighted.
Do you want to just explain it briefly? Well, you know what's going on?
My understanding is that they are looking to sort of close down science in the Albany campus and to move everything to the Palmerston North campus to save money, essentially.
Yeah, would this be because they want to decrease the size of that department, or is it just...
Supposedly removing duplication. They don't want to teach chemistry at both campuses, I think, so they're talking about moving chemistry from here down to Palmerston North.
But it doesn't mean that the teachers can go with...
Well, that's the big imponderable at the moment. And so it sounds like everybody's in limbo. Nobody knows what the hell's happening out there, and it just sounds an appalling state of affairs. So we feel for you folk, and I hope that this leads to a decent outcome. I really do. And also the good old government and their level one standards and stuff, NCEA, they're taking chemistry, physics and everything out of the equation and just having some general science, some touchy-feely stuff, not the specifics.
In level one?
Yes, in level one.
No specifics?
Yeah, no specifics. All general, all cuddly-feely, all NCEA type, and don't start me on this.
Getting into more judgment, no science there.
Me, judgment, come on.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Alan, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Always a pleasure.
Mind blown. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology. Never